He's won 7 statewide elections, blazed a trail for Missouri Republicans, and is a terrific chestnut farmer. That's right. We have former U.S. Senator Kit Bond on the latest edition of Politically Speaking.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I think that is fair
as
to
I say. Hands to kiss and babies to shake.
But you know, I think my record speaks for itself.
It's a really good question.
Hello and welcome to the Politically Speaking podcast. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me is my co-host,
Joe Manis, also with St. Louis Public Radio.
And joining us today, former congressional candidate, former state auditor, former Missouri governor, former U.S. senator, partner with Thompson Coburn, and founder of Kit Bond Strategies, we have as our guest,
Kit Bond, and very good to be with you.
Yes.
Joe and Jason.
We are totally excited. We've been trying to get Senator Bond on for at least 2 years, but he wisely waited till he wanted to make sure we were still going to be around.
He waited to make sure that he wasn't walking into a bunch of yahoos and wackos. But
well,
I think he probably did.
Nobody's guaranteed that I'm not doing now. I just got around to it.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was busy, but I'm excited about having the opportunity to chat with good friends again about whole lot of things, whatever you're interested
in. Well, we're interested in a lot of things, but before we kind of ask for your entire life story, like what are you doing right now? Like what is kind of your post-political career going? How is it going?
It's really fun. When I announced I was retiring from the Senate, somebody asked me, what are you going to do in retirement? I said, let's get something straight. I'm neither shy nor retiring. Mm-hmm. I would go nuts if I didn't have something to do. So I was very fortunate to look at a number of fine law firms. I selected Thompson Coburn in St. Louis with a Washington office, and they now have Chicago offices and L.A. offices. I felt from my standpoint, they were the best large business litigation intellectual property law firm around, and I have been working with them and their clients and helping to bring in new clients for them. And also, as you mentioned, one of my other jobs, I worked with several folks I had been in, had been working for me in government to set up Kit Bond Strategies. There were 4 partners at the time, including my wife Linda and Matt Roney in Kansas City. One of our other partners, Jason Van Eaton from Columbia, left to go with one of the clients we had, Southwest Airlines. And yeah. I was very, very fortunate to be able to latch on to Kenny Hulsoff.
Kenny Hulsoff, former congressman from
Columbia. He's a great, good friend. I talked him into coming with us. So it's now the Kenny and Kit show at Kit Bond Strategies.
So is this like a lobbying firm? Are you like
now? Yeah, we do some lobbying, but we do a whole lot of different things. I started off initially because I'd had such good contacts in Asia, East Asia, that we were taking trade missions to Southeast Asia, working in conjunction with the World Trade Center. We've gotten bigger and bigger. And the last big trade mission we took to Indonesia was in 2014, and we had 16 Missouri businesses, 4 colleges, and people really came out as we went from one end of Indonesia to the other to talk about business opportunities and getting young people in Missouri colleges. So that was the first part. Then we started representing some of our clients in Washington. We do have clients in Washington now that we do some lobbying for. We have one of our team members, Shauna Stribling Marcio, spends full-time in Washington, and she handles the legislative contacts. So, and I do some lobbying there. I'm also at Thompson Coburn, and among other things, I'm on their lobbying and political strategies.
Did you have to wait a couple of years before you could start
lobbying? I couldn't even talk to anybody for 2 years up there.
Yeah.
So, you know.
It's part of the rules. There's no revolving door in Missouri, but there is, I think, a 2-year waiting period for you to lobby anybody in D.C. Is that correct?
You can't lobby any of your former colleagues, and that's where you know, I have so many good friends, and I miss the good friends in the Senate. I try to call Barbara Mikulski on her birthday, and Patty Murray, Dianne Feinstein. I mean, these are really good friends I worked with very closely, and I always say, Mitch McConnell is a good friend, and just a whole group of people. So before we
get into kind of your thoughts on present day, I think we wanted to spend some time talking about your career and kind of how you got into politics. When we have people on this show, we always ask them, like, you know, what did they do before politics? How'd they get in? I'd like to know your story about how you got into politics, and so would Joe, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, because you ended up being Missouri's youngest governor at the time. And I'm just curious about what prompted you to get involved in the first place, especially at a time when Democrats controlled most of Missouri state government. If people can remember way back in the late 60s, early 70s, that was the case. So you want to talk about that a bit. What prompted you to do all this?
My parents were very interested in politics. I didn't find out till later. My mother didn't admit it. But on my father's side, going back to a great-great-great-great-grandfather, who was Joseph Bogie from St. Genevieve County, was a French voyageur poling the Lewis and Clark expedition up the Missouri River. When he came back, he served in the first Assembly Council of Missouri, representing St. Genevieve in 2016. And when the first Assembly Council met, the forerunner of our General Assembly, he was a senator from St. Genevieve. And then we had several more people on Dad's side who ran, and my grandfather, Sam Bond, from Perry County, Missouri, lost and had been elected prosecuting attorney and ran for Congress, but had a very bitter religious divided battle. And my grandmother wanted Dad to stay out of politics, so he stayed out of politics, but his interest never waned. So I talked politics, studied politics, tried practicing law for a while. And
you were practicing mainly in Kansas City, am I correct?
Not
on?
Then.
Okay.
I got a clerkship in Atlanta when I graduated from UVA, and worked for Judge Albert Tuttle,
okay,
who was the leader of the Republican Judges Gang of Four that brought civil rights to Southeast United States. Mm-hmm. He was a very close friend of Martin Luther King, and I went with him on a case where he went in and found a judge in America's Georgia guilty of violating the civil rights of minorities, and it was a very exciting time, great place to be. And then I worked for 3 years for a large law firm in D.C., and I said, that's enough. I'm tired of carrying books. I came back to Mexico, ran for, my home was in Mexico, Missouri.
Correct.
And came back to Mexico and sort of practiced law, but mostly ran for Congress. And in 68 against Bill Hungate.
Somebody, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, nobody thought I had shit. But I came with him, 3% of him, but I got 100,000 Missourians that wanted me to stay home. So Jack Danforth was elected Attorney General. I went to work as counsel in the Consumer Protection Division, and then Jack and I agreed that in 1970 I'd try running for state auditor. So I was elected state auditor in 70, and looked around, didn't see anybody stronger. In 72, I had a really nasty primary battle. They tried to say that I was not a Missourian because I'd gone to school outside the state.
Yeah, that was actually a pretty landmark case from what I remember.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you prevailed, obviously, because you became governor.
Yeah, by 5-2 vote of the Supreme Court, I was and has been and always was a Missourian.
Yeah, and then you won the governorship in 1972. I think you were probably the first Republican governor in, what, 25, 30 years?
28 years.
Yeah. And you were only 33.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because, and I'm sure Joe knows this too, I was showing you your Wikipedia page beforehand. It said that you kind of governed as a quote-unquote moderate when in your first term, and you repealed the Mormon extermination order.
Extermination order,
and
yeah.
I think you were in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment, mm-hmm. and you're probably I would assume pro civil rights as well.
Right.
Like what was it? What was it kind of like? And was that, would that be an accurate summation of your first term?
Oh yes, I had views. We were we had to get state government reorganized, and I fought a long battle to get it reorganized. Fortunately, we got it reorganized because I goofed up in the re-election battle at the in 76, and then I got defeated, and because I spent too much time working on other things, I helped Bill Phelps get him across the line as lieutenant governor.
And that was the year that Jimmy Carter, I mean, just people, history buffs know nationally, Jimmy Carter barely defeated Gerald Ford for the presidency. Mm-hmm. And Carter, of course, carried Missouri. So did the presidential contest have any trickle-down effect, do you think,
in
contributing to
very
your
definitely.
Loss?
Yeah. The people who were supposedly helping me run my campaign were running Gerald Ford's campaign. And one of the bright ideas they had, they told Gerald Ford to move the St. Louis Airport to Columbia, Illinois.
Oh, yes.
And so at the end of the campaign, they said, yeah, Bond's got Missouri on the move to Illinois. And they didn't think I was in trouble. I saw I was in trouble, but I didn't. I couldn't respond. I tried to say that lowering utility rates is a lie.
Right.
But, so I got a lot of experience. As a friend said, experience is what you get when you expect it to get something else.
Yeah. Well, so were you surprised when Teasdale beat you? Or were
well,
you...
I knew it was going downhill, and we couldn't turn it around.
Yeah.
But I came back 4 years later, and I said, take your utility bills to the poll, because utility bills have come back, and I beat him handily.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah.
Yeah, 1980, which was also a landmark year nationally. You know, that was Reagan, a number of Democratic senators almost lost. Tom Eagleton barely won re-election.
And you returned, and I think it was probably similar to this when you were in your first term. When you your second term, you probably had a 70-75% Democratic legislature, kind of a inverse thing of what Governor
yeah.
Nixon is dealing with right now.
Yeah,
but
I've talked with Governor Nixon about that a little bit. Our budget was $900 million out of balance halfway through the year. We got to get it in balance by the end of the year. I worked with Steve Bradford, who was then head of the Office of Administration. I gave the Democratic leadership $1.6 billion worth of actions we could take. I said, pick the least objectionable $900 million. I'll recommend them. You pass them, and I'll sign them. You can say what you want about me, but if you don't pass them, I'm going to have to go across the state from one end to the other. So they passed them, and that began a very fruitful working relationship. We said, you know, what are your top five priorities? I said, here are my five top priorities. I said, let's work on these together. You and I'll work to modify mine and to modify yours. You pass mine, and you pass yours. I'll sign both of them. So when it got down to the end, the very last night of the last session, the legislative leaders wanted a pay increase for the legislature and the judiciary, and that there were three Republican lawyer senators from Southwest Missouri who were filibustering parents as teachers. And
parents as teachers was your brainchild.
Well, so. It was started here in Ferguson, Florissant by Mildred Winter, and it was a program that was working. We wanted to take it statewide, and we had a bill to take it statewide. And came to me that night and said, what would it take to get you to sign the pay increase? I said, you better get that parents as teachers bill passed. So I think a number of judges visited with the Republican lobbying senators.
Oh, wow. It's always the judges.
Filibustering senators. And they decided to drop the filibuster, so I signed a pay increase and the parents as teachers.
But, you know, one of the lingering criticisms of Governor Nixon, and I'm sure of every governor since then, is that he's not collaborative enough with the legislature. I know you probably dealt with that twice, two different terms. Is it so just difficult as governor to deal with a legislature that may not be on the same page, or is it possible to collaborate, as you said?
That is so largely run by the opposition. I mean, in your case, it was all the Democrats who were running.
Well, very simple. You sit down, talk with them. You listen to them. That's what I've done throughout my career.
Yeah, in fact, you were known for that.
Yeah, and I went around, sat in their offices, had them over to the mansion, went out and drank beer with them after the session was over. And that's when we got a lot of work done.
Yeah, I guess that it requires, I'm sure, though, it was an Anheuser-Busch product.
Of course.
Of course, of course.
And I used to have a $50 bill in my wallet, and I'd say, I'll pay it. He said, oh, don't break the 50. So one time they said, we'll take the $50 bill, so I started carrying a $100 bill.
Now, with a four-year gap between your two terms, was there anything particular about your second term that was markedly different from your first term, you know, that you had to deal with things so much differently than you did in your first term?
Well, first term I had to actually I campaigned against Warren Hearns when I ran for Congress, when I ran for auditor, when I ran for governor, and Warren Hearns was extremely helpful in the transition to the governorship. Even warned me about the enemies I would find in my own party.
And just for a listener, Warren Hearns was, I think, the first governor of Missouri to serve two consecutive terms. He was a Democrat from Southeast Missouri.
Southeast Missouri.
Yes. Continue.
And so he was very helpful. But we needed to fighting to reorganize state government was a long time battle, and there were a lot of fiefdoms. Too many people in the legislature had their own little department. One notable opponent controlled the water patrol, and wherever he went, water patrol accompanied him. So I had to break that up, and that was difficult. When I came in the second term, there was a $900 million shortfall. We got that solved, and then they discovered dioxin at Times Beach.
Yes.
And the last two years, the national media was all over, frankly, hyping a problem that was, it had to be dealt with, but it was the dioxin, some people have told me, is about the level of dioxin you have in your fireplace when you burn wood in the stove. So it was diluted, but it had to be dealt with, and the media cry really tied up our Department of Natural Resources, and they spent full time working on that. But I got my priorities passed. The legislature got its priorities passed, and we're still good friends.
Yeah.
So then, two years later, actually, I covered that race because I was in Washington during your second term and actually did a lot of the dioxin stuff, which we won't go into.
Well, we could probably spend the whole show.
but then I ended up was back in St. Louis, and I did cover your 86 race against Harriet Woods.
Which that was a very tough race.
Yeah, it was a very tough. It was narrow. I remember being at victory event for you that night, the election night. And what prompted you, something I've never asked, was what prompted you after you finished that your second term as governor, and of course by that point Ashcroft succeeded you, to decide, you know, I'm going to run for the U.S. Senate? Was there anything in particular that made you decide that you wanted to do that and move to Washington? And the Senate's a whole different animal from mm-hmm. running for governor. I'm just interested in your...
Great challenge. But as I said, I went in as a very interested in politics. Still am interested in politics. And I saw a way open to fill the seat that Tom Eagleton was vacating.
Yeah, correct.
So I thought, hey, I've always wanted... I'd like to get back to serving Missouri. I practiced law in Kansas City with a fine firm, Gage and Tucker, and for 2 years. And I said, I'd rather take a shot at the Senate. And I did. Was thanks to a great statewide organization we call the Bond Organization,
yes,
or the Bond Brigade. Yeah. Some people accused us of having a machine, and I'd like to think we were guilty of that. But I was a couple points behind in the polls on that weekend before, but agreed with my advisors that our bond organization would turn out the votes, and so they did turn out the votes and we won it, but it was a cliffhanger.
So, yeah, and then you became a U.S. Senator. I got at this folder now for, I guess, 24 years?
Yes.
24
yes.
years. Mm-hmm.
And I think that, I kind of alluded to it before, there's some perception that you became more politically conservative in the U.S. Senate than when you were governor. Like, how do you respond to that perception?
I don't think I changed. I listened to the people in Missouri, tried to do what was right. There were some very the split between Democrats and Republicans was far more pronounced in Washington than in Jefferson mm-hmm. City. Mm-hmm. In Jefferson City, I felt I was part of the mainstream, and certainly in Washington, I was more mainstream than right wing because I did a whole lot of things mm-hmm. that were. That certainly wouldn't be considered conservative.
Yeah, and I think you worked for. Yeah, I was going to say, by modern Republican standards, I still think you were probably center right or a centrist, basically. Mm-hmm. But as you were about to say, so
yeah. Continue. Well, because I listened to what the needs were of people. I visited the inner cities and found where there were needs. I helped get housing. One of the things we did, we fought hard to reform housing so we could. Get the law changed to, as Mayor Shamer right. wanted, to get rid of Vaughan Public Housing, which
yes.
was, as my partner on the Appropriations Committee, Barbara Mikulski, said, it's a zip code of pathology. There was drugs, single mother families,
right.
Prostitution, terrible place to raise kids. We got that torn down and replaced it with Murphy Park. Thanks to Richard Barron and his great ideas. Mm-hmm. And by the way, when I served on the Bipartisan Policy Center from 2011 to 2014, and they came out to see what Richard Barron had done in St. Louis.
Of McCormick Barron.
Yeah, McCormick yes. Barron, and to see how housing could be changed. But I also fought for things like family and medical leave. I got that changed. So, and got Republicans to support it by saying that the small businesses under 50 would be excluded. But we got it passed for the rest of the people. I spent a lot of time fighting to get good health care, because our state really has a lot of people who need assistance, yes. and everything from the places like Truman Hospital and the essentially public charity type hospitals
right.
in St. Louis needed the money, the disproportionate share. I fought to get community health centers or federally qualified health agencies,
yes.
and we expanded by that effort. I took George W. Bush, when he was campaigning in '80, to Grace Hill. Showed him what a community health center did to serve the needs of low-income people in the cities, and got his support. So we got federal support for community health centers and a whole range of things like that that certainly don't fit the model of what you might call a hard right-wing
yeah.
conservative.
Yeah, because you gained a reputation in Congress, I think even more so than you did as governor. Of like a lot of the senators that you've mentioned are Democrats. In other words, you may have disagreed with them on stuff, but you could talk to them.
Sure.
And you were known for that, you know, being able to talk to people on the other side and cutting up with compromise. And you were also good at getting money for various Missouri projects. That now, that seems to be an anomaly
yeah.
among many senators in both parties.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like it's almost discouraged to be dealing too much with the other side.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, Joe, because I remember when I started, you know, covering you and covering Congressman Holsoff for the Columbia Tribune, it seemed like you, even if you weren't in the majority, you were still getting money for roads and for buildings and, you know, getting money back to Missouri, essentially. And now it seems like I'm not really sure what the Congress people do if they're not able to get resources as easily anymore.
Well,
have you noticed a change?
Oh, yeah. Well, getting rid of what they call earmarks. Strategic investments was one of the stupidest ideas that came out of the Republicans in the House. The Constitution, Article 1, says that Congress shall appropriate money and spend it. Not we shall appropriate a whole bunch of money and let all the bureaucrats in Washington spend it. I saw too many instances where the bureaucrats in Washington didn't know what the problems were in Missouri. So I fought hard. I worked with Democrats, Ted Stevens when Republicans were in the majority, Dan Inouye when Democrats, to get resources that the communities needed and were supporting at the local level.
So why do you think, I mean, because it became a drumbeat, and even McCaskill was one of the players in trying to get rid of earmarks. Why do you think there was that drive? Because as you say, one of the upshots of it is that bureaucrats are the ones who determine where a lot of
the
money
goes. Or the executive branch is the driver now.
Yeah, well, in effect, the bureaucrats work for the executive branch.
But yeah.
I think it was, I think there were one or two examples where people got money that was, corrupt. They were getting money.
Sure.
For their family or for property they owned and things like that. And people went to prison, which they should.
Sure.
Which they should. But I've stood up on the floor and defended earmarks. John McCain went after me for getting money for a bridge in Missouri. He said, what are you doing using highway money for bridges? I said, my friend from Arizona comes from a dry state, but in Missouri, we were divided by a river. North and south, we are limited by a river, east and west. And if we can't get across the river, we don't go.
Yeah.
And I said, bridges are part of highways.
I have to ask this question. Is it sometimes a little jarring for you when you drive over the bridge in Herman or Kansas City and it's named after you?
Well, it was they were kind enough to name it after me. The interesting thing about the Bond Bridge in Kansas City, my brother-in-law, Linda's brother, Dick Holwick, kept pounding on me to get a bridge. I got the Paseo Bridge, and he kept pounding on me at Thanksgiving. And so I finally got the money for the bridge. And Dick had been chairman of the Citizens Committee that was working for a design for the bridge. And he came up with the design, which I think is beautiful. And he was dying of bone cancer. So he gave the inaugural speech at the cutting of the ribbon 4 months before he died. And so I call it the Dick Holwick Kit Bond Bridge.
That's a really nice story. That's very touching.
So now, okay, I mean, so you're, you know, in the Senate, you had a couple, well, you had a tough reelection in 1992. I remember that well, partly because of the whole Clinton wave where you had, so that had an impact. You were...
And then you were
running against Jerry Rothman Surratt on the.
Fortunately, she didn't work very. She didn't cover a lot of the state. I covered a lot more of the state than she.
And
did.
Then you.
But
ran,
it still ended up being a fairly close finish. I remember watching the totals that night, and for a while, it was unclear what was going to happen.
Yeah.
Now, in 1998, you ran against
Jay Nixon.
Our current governor, Jay Nixon, and things were a little easier. And in part, a lot of the African some of the African American officials in the St. Louis area backed you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there, which is something that a lingering tension that continues to plague the governor. So, but I'm interested in, as you started from 24 years, from when you started at the beginning until your last term, were there any things in particular that you noticed that changed, either as the Senate, as an institution, or how you had to deal with things differently, aside from the earmark issue?
Unfortunately, in 2009, the Senate stopped functioning. When President Obama was elected and Harry Reid had a 60-vote majority, the word went out, expressed to us by the actions of Harry Reid, that Republicans shouldn't even bother to show up. We couldn't introduce a bill and get it considered for the floor. We couldn't introduce an amendment. We couldn't get a vote on an amendment. Everything that came to the Senate floor was written either in Nancy Pelosi's office with the help of the administration or Harry Reid's office. And it totally stopped functioning. And I believed then, and I'm firmly convinced now, that anytime you have a totally partisan piece of legislation, you've got a pile of manure. And I think that's been proven right, because they're seeing the problems in Obamacare were never fully debated and aired out, and people are really shocked because, as Nancy Pelosi said, when we pass it, you'll find out what's in it. And they found out what was in it, and there are things that are not that do not work properly. And that really, even in the Intelligence Committee, where I was serving on the Intelligence Committee, they had a Democratic war room to work against President Bush, and in the early 2000s, and we found
when the Democrats took back control after the 2006 election.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
okay.
Yeah. And they said they were going to run the Intelligence Committee to embarrass President Bush. And after that, even when in 2007, we needed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act passed. I was with a bipartisan group of Intelligence Committee members in Iraq, and the general said we need to have FISA passed so we can capture information on not only what the terrorists are doing to threaten the United States, but to protect our men and women serving here from terrorist attacks, which could be identified by intercepting their cell phones, which you couldn't do until we changed the law. Well, Son Sam happened to be serving in Fallujah as a sniper platoon commander at the time, and when I heard that, I went to work, and we got a bipartisan group over the objection of Jay Rockefeller, the chairman of the Intel Committee, and Barack Obama on the floor. And we got it passed, and I worked with Roy Blunt to convince Speaker Pelosi to let it go through. So that was the biggest, most important battle I fought right at the end.
Now, of course, Roy Blunt at that time was still in the House.
Yes, he was in the House.
Just for our listeners.
I do want to ask this question, and we're going slightly backwards, but you did get to vote, I guess, on the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War as well. And as you alluded to, I mean, this had a personal stake for you because your son was in the Marines and he was basically sent off to Iraq. Like, what was your thought process going through your mind when you had to vote the second time?
Actually, I voted for the first Gulf War and the Iraq authorization for the use of force in Iraq. And I guess that was 2002.
Yeah.
But Sam didn't join the Marines until 2003.
Okay. That's right.
So that wasn't a consideration.
No, but I mean, the first time I voted for it, I felt physically drained. I mean, it was really draining to send people into battle. Mm-hmm. And then when Sam went in, I sucked it up, but I found out what other family members experienced because our clock radio would go off at 6 o'clock in the morning in Washington, would start off, 3 Marines killed in Iraq today. I sit up straight in bed. And that's what other families of servicemen and women in battle face.
As a senator and also as a parent of someone who was in Iraq, when you look, I mean, there's still controversy over whether or not we ever should have gone in. Looking back now, I mean, you know, any thoughts about, I mean, just in general, about whether or not the Iraq war, do you feel that it ended up being justified, or do you think there was problems with how it was conducted? I'm just interested in your take, especially because you have a perspective of being on the Intelligence Committee, of being one of the more powerful senators at the time, and then also your son ended up, you know, being a major military figure there.
Well, let me give you the end of the story.
Sure.
We did pacify Iraq. We kept the Taliban and al-Qaeda under control. We had them under control in 2011. Both President Obama and Vice President Biden said, oh, Iraq is safe and calm, and they made the terrible mistake of pulling all the American troops out. When they did that, they released the choke chain the American military had on Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. He was an Iranian Shia, and he started abusing the Sunnis immediately. filed criminal charges against Sunni vice premier and member of this parliament. That started the warfare. That opened the way for the warfare, the total destabilization
yeah.
of the military. Now, we started off with shock and awe, which won in the first Gulf War, but that was not getting anywhere.
Right.
And Bob Gates brought in David Petraeus, and his counterinsurgency strategy said, we use lethal force to stop the killing, to stop people who are killing us or our friends. But then we provide reparations, we provide health care. In Fallujah, they signed up Sunni young men to serve in the Sunni police. They brought in, they signed up many in the Sunni Citizens Watch. So when somebody brought an IED into Fallujah, or somebody with al-Qaeda showed up in Fallujah, the Sunni Citizen Watch told the Sunni police, and they took care of it. So Sam's snipers were not needed by about a month after they cleaned out Fallujah. And we forced al-Maliki to treat the Sunnis equally, even as a violent Iranian Shia. And with that, our presence there, and it could only be 20,000 or even 10,000 would have made a difference. Mm-hmm.
So now, I mean, you know, of course, ISIS is largely Sunni.
Mm-hmm.
There's still all this stuff going on in the Middle East. As someone who'd been heavily involved in all that, is there anything that you think can be done, or is it just this?
Well,
just
we can't draw red lines in the sand in Syria and then back away from them. We've gone in and under the current administration and asked the Arab Gulf people to join us. We went in and sent some bombing runs in Libya, and then they mobilized the Arab Gulf. They went in and we abandoned them. And now they are furious at the United States for starting something and saying, we're not going to have anything to do with it. And right now we're seeing what I consider to be the very dangerous situation when America refuses to lead in the world, to provide a strong force and a strong voice for human rights, non-aggression, free markets. We see things falling apart. When the Arab Spring has gone
right.
bad, ISIS is almost unchecked, and now Russia is meddling and trying to expand its coverage, and I see many, many difficult international security challenges facing the next president. We've lost all the strength, all the reputation, the strength that we had as leading the community of nations.
Well, let's kind of we've spent a lot of time delving into your past. Let's get into the present right now. And your past is incredibly fascinating, by the way.
Yeah. So, who are you backing for president at this point?
I'm backing Jeb Bush.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So,
Jeb,
do you feel he's the best one?
Well,
to
yeah, I think he's the best. I think he has served well as a governor. I like the fact that he has a Spanish connection. He speaks Spanish. I think we need to appeal to the Hispanics. I think that it's difficult having a name Bush, and this seemed to be slowing him down. But I think the last time he came through town, he was very compelling, and he was making his case, and he has to make his case because this is a very very difficult.
Strange. It's a strange election cycle. I mean,
yeah.
That's an understatement.
Now you've also taken a stand in the Missouri governor's race. You're supporting Catherine Hanaway, who a long time ago had been one of your top aides.
She ran the St. Louis office for me. And when she left the office to run for state representative, she also joined my 98 campaign as the director of research and had her first child. So you talk about doing three jobs at once, and she did them well. I told her at the time that when I helped her, I campaigned for and raised money for candidates for the House, helped her get a majority. I told her I wanted to see her run for governor, and I'd support her. So she t- took her a long time to get around to it, but she's doing it now, so
now,
I'm supporting her.
You and Hannaway don't agree on everything, though.
Of course
because,
not.
I mean, she's
never expected to.
Most of the, I mean, all of the Republican candidates, for example, oppose Medicaid expansion. And you had been a consultant hired to try to persuade the legislature to change their mind on that. So even though you've been critical of the Affordable Care Act, you were pushing for that. I'm interested in your take on why you thought that expanding Medicaid was a good idea. Do you think that Missouri now has just missed it or whatever? And how do you think that's going to affect the politics over the next year? Because you will be involved in some way.
One of the great tragedies of Obamacare was it was funded by taking $2 billion from Missouri's health care for the poor. That's health care that supported the public agencies that were providing health care for those at the bottom of the ladder.
So you're talking about the DSH, what's known as the DSH
disproportionate
payments.
Share hospital payments. And the community health centers, as a result, many small hospitals are going out of business. Their top young physicians are leaving. They're being poached by Illinois, Iowa, and even on the southern border by Arkansas.
Yeah, which did expand Medicaid.
And that's because they have expanded Medicaid. Now, Medicaid, we work with Senator Ryan Silvey, formerly a staffer of mine in Washington, who is now head of the second in line in the Appropriations Committee in the Senate. We developed a conservative plan which would put the Medicaid eligible people up to 138% of poverty, which was required.
Correct.
Put them on a either managed care or a private voucher fee for service kind of plan. Or maybe a direct payment plan. We wanted to the Medicaid in Missouri has some real problems, and people didn't want to just expand the Medicaid problem. But this was a new approach which would have returned the $2 billion that Missouri lost. Right now, it's a great big hole in the budget, and we don't have health care for those neediest of people. We have Medicaid covers right now the people up to 10% of poverty.
Well, that was going to be my next question. We could get into the minutiae of the politics, but the big thing that happened in 2005 was that many of the Republicans on this folder that you handed voted to cut Medicaid to basically for budgetary reasons. And it was a very controversial vote. It was controversial for then-Governor Matt Blunt. And many of the people that did that are still in the legislature, and they feel like they need to stand by that and not cave, essentially. Is that, I think, one of the reasons, is that, in your opinion, one of the reasons you think it's so hard to get Republicans on board for Medicaid expansion because they cut it so deeply in 2005 and they don't want to reverse their positions on it?
No, most of the people who did that have lost the term limits now. They've left. What they really don't like is it's supporting Obamacare. I said, listen, gang, this is not supporting Obamacare. This is repairing a big hole in the bottom of our
because
boat that Obamacare blew by cutting the funds, the DSH payments, the funds for public support of low-income people with health care.
Do you think that some members of the legislature don't get it? I mean, the fact that there was the money, the DSH payments that are being cut out, so the federal money that used to come in to help pay for hospitals to care for the poor is being cut out. And it was supposed to be replaced by Medicaid, as you mentioned, Medicaid expansion. And they didn't want to do that. So, like you say, there's this hole. Is part of the because many of them would prefer just keeping the DSH payments, which isn't going to happen probably. So I'm interested in your take. What happens now? I mean, are you still?
It gets worse. It gets worse. The penalties get worse.
So what do you think is going to happen?
Well, it depends on whether the people who want us to engage will want us to engage again. That was essentially the community health centers, the Missouri Chamber of Commerce. They were the ones that we worked for on that first go-around and whether they want us to do so again. But whoever is the next governor is going to be facing a budget with a big hole blown in it by the cut of the federal funds and no corresponding federal funding for Medicaid expansion.
So, I mean, of course, so far, Hanaway has said she's against Medicaid expansion.
And so is, I mean, Kinder's against it, Bruner, Greitens, Dixon. I'm sure all of them are, basically.
Hanaway has said, I want to see a Missouri solution. And I think most of them, if we will come back with them, if our clients decide to come back, it will be for a Missouri solution. And we would try to push a Missouri solution, because otherwise our state is going to be floundering and it's going to be a big drain on the state budget.
Now, I think kind of staying in the realm of politics, I mean, when you were governor in 72 and in 1980, you were kind of surrounded, as we kind of mentioned before, that a legislature was overwhelmingly Democratic. And it was basically Missouri was still kind of a Democratic-controlled state. Now you have a situation where the Republicans now dominate rural Missouri. I'm sure I would have told you back in 1972 that Republicans held every single seat in Northeast Missouri where you're from, you probably would have fainted and said I was crazy. But that's the situation right now. But conversely, Republicans seem to have a lot of trouble winning statewide. Like, what's kind of your lay of the land of this? It's kind of fascinating.
And any suggestions for your party?
Oh, I think we need to get good, strong candidates running. I've talked to several of them who are running. I think we've got we need to have good, strong candidates with statewide appeal. And I'm not I've got a full-time job with a law firm, with Kit Bond Strategies.
Sure.
Past year, I've been lecturing on art on the Bingham Sketches here in Fort Worth and St. Louis Art Museum and the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the Bingham Sketches.
Yeah. So.
That was more fun. I spent too much time on it, in 76 and rather than spending time on the election.
Yeah, but actually, I mean, just so our listeners know, you, in effect, while you were governor, actually saved those sketches from going up for auction.
We raised $1.8 million to buy the 112 Bingham Sketches, original drawings that Bingham did as a portrait painter, and he traced them on to his genre paintings, which were, I think, some of the best genre paintings in the 19th century. They now are insured for about $22 or $24 million.
And it's interesting. I saw the sketches at the art museum here, and it says that they are presented by the people of Missouri because of the money raised.
Yeah, we had 100,000 Missourians, including 50,000 school children. That was a fun part.
Yeah.
School children had car washes. They brought in nickels and dimes, and they bought drawing of Bingham's son Horace. And Horace shows up in several of the paintings in the foreground playing Mumbly Peg.
I wanted to get back just a little bit to what may be facing the next governor. You're talking about the financial problems. What role do you think needs to be played by the General Assembly in trying to resolve some of this? Are there any suggestions that you have? I mean, do you still feel strongly for Medicaid expansion? Are there other issues? I know a lot of people have been talking about some sort of transportation plan, which you had been pushing for way back when you were governor. I'm interested in kind of your observations of what you see as the most serious needs facing the state right now.
Well, I would agree that those two are tops right now because when you look at a map of the United States to see where the traffic goes. And the Federal Highway Administration has a map showing truck traffic. And the lines get redder the more truck traffic there are. We've got red lines on 70, I-44, 61, and it comes together in one great big blob in St. Louis. And we have far too much traffic on the roads that we have now, and we have rural roads that are not up to standards. I have spent a lot of time on I-70 when I thought it was the world's longest parking lot, and when it slows down, we need to have better roads. I fought for roads, I won money for roads, both as on the authorizing committee and the appropriating committee when I was in the Senate, and I know that we need better roads, and so I can't solve all the problems. But I'd say that filling the Medicaid expansion hole, getting some kind of funding. I had expected before they had a vote that the governor would come out and lead and give plenty of time to develop a campaign to pass a sales tax or whatever other means of funding the legislature and the governor can agree on.
For transportation.
For transportation. So what do you think about some proposals to either increase the gas tax? There have been talk about toll roads, at least I-70. I just came off of I-90 in northern New York, which is a toll road. I'm just interested in your take on that.
Well, I've fought those battles all different ways. And when I talked about toll roads, the truckers opposed them because they couldn't factor the tolls into their freight charges. There either way to fix that. I really, at this point, I'm going to have to leave it to the people who are taking direct responsibility and find something, because we are the federal government is out of highway money and the state of Missouri is right up against the wall.
Now, this is going to be the last thing I'm going to ask you before we let you go. Back in 2006, when I was with the Columbia Tribune, I was given an envious assignment to ask politicians in Boone County about Boone County ham, which for our listeners who may not know, is this dried ham that is incredibly salty that's served every year at the Boone County Fair. And many of the Boone County area people told me like great things about how great Boone County ham was and said it was the best ham ever. You provided what I believe is one of the best responses to a question I have ever had by a politician. I will read it verbatim. I think it has a tough battle against Montauk County ham and, let's see, Osceola and Lexington and Lafayette County. It's always fun to try it out to see which one's best. And I haven't made up my mind, but I look forward to continually sampling to see if I can see an edge emerging from one of our competing counties for county-cured ham. Now, I love that answer because you were not trying to suck up to a Boone County reporter by saying Boone County ham was the best. But I do have to ask, did you ever find out which ham around the state was the best?
I haven't eaten enough of them. I'm still working on it. And at the time, Jason, you were probably the last person I was going to give a scoop on Boone County ham. So I thought I would duck that. But really, I have. There's burger hams. They're great. They're great hams, and the state fair in Sedalia has the champion hams, and I have tasted some of those, and they come from all over Missouri.
I just knew when you gave that answer, you're past the time where you have to say every ham is the best, and I thought that was great. I will just say for the record, Boone County ham is way too salty. It's just not very good.
Now, before we Uh-oh. Can't leave without talking about one of his other enterprises, which actually may or may not go well with ham, the Bond Orchard Chestnuts.
In Mexico, Missouri.
Yes. Now, you have an orchard that is trying to revive chestnuts as a Missouri crop. Do you want to talk just a little bit about that?
Okay, I'll make that very brief, but I've worked with the University of Missouri Agroforestry Department and the Agricultural Forestry Department. And we worked on very, very many environmental projects, but we also worked on projects to help small farmers. And it was the view of the great guru, my dear friend Gene Garrett, that we could get chestnuts started, because chestnuts used to be one of the favored nuts in America. Everybody had chestnut stuffing in fall and roasted chestnuts. And we started it. I have about an acre and a half. We produce anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 pounds of chestnuts a year. I sell them to restaurants, but I started selling them to Forest Keeling Nursery, and they found that the chestnuts I had, which according to an expert were the wrong kind of chestnuts planted on the wrong kind of ground, are very hardy, because under the Darwinian theory, they had to be tough, and the air root pruning process that Wayne Lovelace uses at Forest Keeling gets tremendous growth, and they start producing nuts in about 3 years as opposed to 9 to 10 years. And very soon, with all the seedlings they're selling, I won't be the largest chestnut producer, but there'll be a lot of small farms in Missouri that can make a good second income producing chestnuts.
A surprising legacy of yours will be chestnuts.
So you'll be the father of the chestnut resurrection in Missouri.
Your mark on Missouri is indelible, Senator. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're thrilled to have you and talking about your life and career. To close us out, find all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. Follow Joe on Twitter at
Jay Manis. That's J-M-A-N-N-I-E-S.
And you may not know this. You're actually on Twitter at Kit Bon Mo. And you, this is you in a Cardinals hat right now.
Well, I rooted for the Cardinals all the way. I'm ready to start. I will go, Linda and I'll go back to Jupiter in late March to start them again. But she's from Kansas City. I lived 10 years in Kansas City. We were at the last year, World Series game in 2014 when Madison Bumgarner beat the Royals. So now it's go Royals, and I want to see them go all the way.
I do, too. I'm a White Sox fan, but I'm a big fan of Kauffman Stadium. So we'll be back next time. Until then, so long.
So long.